Welcome. Today we're diving into a corner of pure math that actually shapes a lot of real-world network problems. We're talking about random paths, specifically finding the quickest way through a system where everything's a bit, well, random. It's called first passage percolation, or FPP. Imagine, say, a wildfire spreading, or maybe just how fast information gets across the internet. The time it takes for any single step is unpredictable. FPP tries to figure out the minimum total time, the passage time, tell of all. So our mission today is to really get into an academic paper looking at how quickly this random travel time actually settles down to a predictable average. We're after the rate of convergence, especially when the researchers are trying to use, surprisingly, very little info about the randomness itself.
That's right. So the setup is usually a grid, like a D-dimensional lattice. Think math BB, ZED, where D is two or more. And every connection, every edge E, gets a random weight, T dollars. It's non-negative, representing time or cost. Now, the passage time, tau y, is just the smallest total weight you can find along any path from point X to point Y. And the amazing thing about FPP, the foundational idea, is that even with all that local randomness, things smooth out over large distances. If you look at the time to get way out, like tau dollars in X, and divide by n, that value actually converges. Almost surely, it converges to a fixed non-random number as n gets really big.
That's the time constant.
Exactly. And this Majorelle defines a kind of ideal asymptotic shape of the spread. We call it the limit shape, B dollars.
Okay, so it's like the theoretical speed limit in a given direction. And we want to know how quickly the actual random time tau's bouncing around and gets close to that limit.
Precisely. And what makes this paper by Damron and Kubota really stand out is they're asking, what are the absolute minimal conditions we need on those random weights, $2? Historically, people assumed a lot about the weights to prove things about convergence rates. These researchers are focused on doing it with what they call only low moments, much weaker assumptions.
Okay, let's dig into that. What was the old way? What were the standard assumptions people used before this? And why are these low moments such a big change?
Well, the classic work, especially for getting sharp convergence rates, like from Alexander back in 97, relied heavily on something called exponential moments. Mathematically, that means E alpha t had to be finite for some positive alpha.
Which basically means you're assuming the really extreme high-cost events are super rare, right? Like their probability drops off exponentially fast.
Exactly. It assumes the tails of the probability distribution are very thin, like a nice, well-behaved Gaussian curve, roughly speaking.
But real-world noise often doesn't behave like that. Think network lag, market crashes.
Right. You get fat tails.
Uh-huh.
Events that are far from the average happen more often than an exponential distribution would predict. So that assumption is often too strong for practical models.
Okay. So if they threw out that really strict requirement, what's the minimum they did need? Mm-hmm. These conditions, A1 and A2.
Right. There are two crucial ones. A2 is pretty basic. It just makes sure a path actually exists. It says the probability an edge has zero weight, PET, has to be below the percolation threshold, PTO.
Makes sense. If too many edges are free instantaneous connections, the whole idea of a shortest time breaks down.
Right. The interesting part, the real shift, is in A1. This is the low moment condition. It requires that dy22 is finite, so the second moment exists. But here's the key. D isn't the edge weight T$2 itself.
Oh, what is Y then?
Y is defined as the minimum of D independent copies of T$.
Huh. The minimum of D copies. Mm-hmm. Why that specific variable?
Think about being at a point on the grid in D dimensions. You have $2 directions you could go. Dollar captures the time it takes for the fastest possible way out of your immediate vicinity. By just needing the second moment, just one Y$2 of this minimum exit time to be finite, they get enough control. It's much, much weaker than needing control over the exponential moments of every single dollars. You can have individual dollars with quite fat tails as long as the easiest way out isn't too wildly unpredictable.
Ah, okay. That's clever. You don't need every possible path to be well-behaved, just assurance that there's some reasonable way forward from any point. So why is the rate of convergence itself so important? Why do we care how fast tau dollars approaches?
It's really about the geometry, the structure of the optimal path. We want to know how much the actual passage time deviates, plus text error. That error term is often written like the exponent A tells you how the error grows with distance. Mm. If A is less than 1, say A12 tau 2, that's huge. It means the error grows slower than the distance itself. Sublinear growth.
And sublinear growth means?
It means the random shortest path, the geodesic, stays incredibly close to the straight line, defined by the deterministic limit across Demoxer's. It doesn't wiggle around too much. It's stable. This geometric stability is essential. If the error grew linearly, the path could wander quite a bit. But sublinear error gives you predictability. It's needed for other results, like proving bounds on the variance of the passage time.
Right, this is where it gets really interesting, because the old work using those strict exponential moment assumptions got a certain rate. But this paper uses weaker assumptions, just these low moments, and they actually get a better, faster rate. How does that work? Using less information to get a sharper result seems counterintuitive.
It does sound a bit like magic, doesn't it? But it's about using more sophisticated mathematical tools. Let's look at the bounds. Under the old strong exponential moment conditions, the best known bound on the expected deviation was less than or equal to log lambda.
Okay, so the main term there is linear in distance plus a log factor.
Exactly. Now, the big result in this paper, proposition 1.1, changes the game. Under only their weak low moment conditions, A1 and A2, they show E tau X1.
Wow. Okay, hold on. The whole thing is now under a square root. That Cottle term is effectively behaving like CO12. That's a massive improvement. From linear dependence on distance down to square root dependence, that changes the whole picture of how stable this thing is. How on earth did they manage that without the exponential moments?
The engine behind this is a new concentration inequality, theorem 2.1. They needed to prove that the passage time, let's call it 2 to ATX or X, doesn't just converge, but it clusters very tightly around its expected value. Specifically, they show it has Gaussian-like concentration in its lower tail. The probability that T is much smaller than its mean decays very fast. PET, ET, LEC, ECOT, C1C, that's Skort, Maughan scaling. And the 2 Togo 2 in the exponent, that's characteristic of Gaussian concentration.
And they proved this concentration just using the low moment condition A1.
Yes. They extended earlier work that needed finite variance for $2 itself. They achieved this using something called the entropy method, combined with a clever technique called block tensorization.
The entropy method.
Mm.
Could you give us the intuition behind that, without getting too deep in the weeds?
Sure. Think of entropy as measuring randomness or uncertainty. The entropy method looks at how sensitive the overall uncertainty of the passage time T is to small changes in the individual edge weights T to lollers. By carefully analyzing the sensitivity, using information theory concepts, they can show that the total uncertainty is well controlled, leading to this tight concentration. It's a way to prove predictability by controlling how randomness propagates, rather than needing to know detailed information about the extreme values of the weights themselves.
That's really neat. Control the spread of uncertainty, not the source distribution directly.
Mm.
Okay, so this better bound on the deviation, how does it impact the bigger picture, the overall shape of the spread, the limit shape, B dollars and dollars?
Directly. A tighter bound on the time deviation translates immediately into a tighter bound on how closely the actual growing shape resembles the ideal limit shape. Theorem 1.2 in the paper addresses this. It looks at WBT, which is the set of all points you can reach by time T dollars, and it asks how fast the scaled shape, WBTT, converges to the theoretical limit, BD dollars. So for the outer bound that's proving the random shape, BD doesn't grow too far outside the limit, B dollars, they show it's contained within a B dollars plus a small margin. And under their weak conditions, A1, A2, this margin shrinks like 2 C dollar, 12 to under dollar.
Okay, T dollar scaling again, that's consistent. And how does that compare to before?
It's better. Alexander's previous bound under stronger conditions had a margin like D12 log T. So they improved the logarithmic factor from log to down to we remit, but significant.
Got it. And what about the other side of the coin? Proving the limit shape B to dollars is fully contained inside the random shades, the inner bound. That sounds harder.
It is generally harder, yes. You need to make sure no part of the boundary lags too far behind due to some unlucky patch of slow edges. For this inner bound, they do need slightly stronger conditions than just A1, A2. They require 80 T alpha and 50 for some alpha 1 plus 1 D long.
So still not exponential moments, but a bit more than just the second moment of that minimum Y variable. You need some finite moments slightly bigger than 1 for the individual edge weights.
Correct. It's still a polynomial moment, much weaker than exponential. Under the slightly stronger assumption, they get an inner bound where the convergence margin is 3C3$I2L4.
Hmm. Okay, so T12 again, but the log factor is a bit worse here, log T42.
Yeah.
It's really interesting how the precise moment condition you need depends on exactly what you're trying to prove, outer versus inner bounds.
It really highlights the trade-offs. Minimal information gets you quite far, especially for the outer bound, but guaranteeing everything converges nicely from the inside requires just a touch more control over potential slowdowns.
So wrapping this part up, the big takeaway for anyone listening, maybe thinking about applying this, this work shows you can get substantially better performance, a fundamentally faster convergence rate, square root instead of linear, even with much weaker assumptions about the randomness in your network.
Yeah.
Less restrictive models can still yield strong geometric certainty.
Exactly. But there's a final interesting wrinkle the authors point out. It's a bit subtle. Remember that concentration inequality, theorem 2.1? It showed Gaussian concentration scaling with score doc. That suggests maybe the ultimate deviation bound should just be just the doll without any log factors.
But the final result, proposition 1.1, still had that log 2 factor attached to the square root term.
Precisely. So even though their core concentration results seemed purely square root, the final bound on the expected deviation didn't quite get there. It kept that extra log factor.
Where does that log factor come from then, if it's not from the concentration itself?
According to the paper, it's an artifact of the technique used to bridge the gap between the concentration result and the final expectation bound. They use a method largely based on Alexander's earlier work for approximating these kinds of subadditive functions like the passage time. And that approximation method seems to introduce this persistent logarithmic factor.
So it might not be fundamental to the FDP process itself, but rather a limitation of the current mathematical toolbox used to analyze it.
That seems to be the suggestion. The underlying concentration might be cleaner, might be truly awful, but proving the final bound on the expectation required a tool that added this extra log term back in.
Which leaves us with a really interesting question to ponder, doesn't it? For anyone working with these models, is that lingering logarithm just a ghost in the machine? An artifact of the proof technique that someone might eventually figure out how to remove? Or is there something deeper about undirected FPP that inherently requires this slightly slower convergence, this logarithmic correction, compared to what the raw concentrations suggest?
Yeah.
That's the open question. Is there a log-free, square root bound waiting to be discovered?
Something to think about. An excellent place to leave our deep dive for today.